Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media Network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion and have written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture. And with me today is my co-host, Liz.
Hi, everyone. I'm Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a graduate student at BYU, and a Latter-day Saint.
All right. And joining us today, we have one repeat guest and one new guest. Ivan, could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Ivan Wolf. I teach English at Arizona State University. I have a PhD from the University of Texas at Austin. I publish a lot on pop culture and philosophy. I'm also a bluegrass musician and a Highland Games athlete.
And joining us for the first time is Michael. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, I'm Michael Haycock. I have an MA in religion, writing on Mormon topics in part, and I currently work in Georgetown University's Office of Mission and Ministry.
Welcome, one and all. Today, we'll be talking about Dune Parts 1 and 2, Denis Villeneuve's two-part film adaptation of the classic science fiction novel by Frank Herbert. But first, our Best Books segment, where we each recommend one thing that we are watching, reading, or listening to. I'm going to get us started. I have finally picked up another Brandon Sanderson book. I read Elantris years ago and just never got into him, but I'm in the middle of Warbreaker right now, and I'm really enjoying it. I see what everybody has been telling me about his magic systems and just the way he constructs his world and sorts of things, and really enjoying it. So I can recommend at least the first two-thirds of the book. I haven't quite finished it yet, but I can tell it's getting good, you guys. I'm going to absorb it in the next day or so. Something else I'd also like to recommend, which was something that I didn't expect to enjoy as much as I did, was a graphic novel called Superman Camelot Falls. It's interesting to see through the eyes of Superman, who I think is a really boring character in some ways. What do you do? What kind of drama can you have with somebody who is so powerful that basically he can smoke anybody? But addresses the philosophical question of, if Superman is saving all of us humans all the time, will we ourselves stagnate as a culture, and will that in the end run be bad for us? And so I thought that was actually a good philosophical sort of conversation to have around a character like Superman, and I enjoyed it. And those are my two recommendations this time, Warbreaker by Brandon Sanderson and Superman Camelot Falls, a graphic novel that's a collection of various individual episodes, of course, of the Superman comic series. Liz, what have you got for us this time?
My recommendation today is the Three Body Problem adaptation by Netflix. I read the book a while back. It's a translation of a Chinese novel, which is really fascinating, but it felt classic era sci-fi in that it didn't have a lot of character work. It was all about the ideas. And the Netflix adaptation really fixed it for a modern audience, or a Western audience, maybe. It added a lot more of the character beats that we would usually expect from modern science fiction or fantasy novel, but it kept all of the really cool ideas that are going on in the three-body problem. I just really loved it. Big content warning, lots of swearing. There is some nudity in there. Just know your limits, but I really enjoyed it for good science fiction. And then my less content warning-y suggestion is I've been rereading Matched by Ali Condy, which is part of that era of YA dystopia explosion in the early 2010s. Ali Condy is a member of the church. I read Matched back then and loved it, and I've been rereading it because I'm working on a paper on it, and it is fantastic. I forgot how good her writing is. It's far too good for the YA dystopia that it was in. But it's just lovely and quiet and scholarly YA dystopia. Yes, that's a thing, apparently. And it's so good. Yeah, lots of poetry in there. Just wonderful. I highly recommend Matched by Ali Condy and The Three Body Problem by Netflix.
Yeah, I can second The Three Body Problem. If you can get past the content warning, there is some really interesting stuff going on in that show. And I look forward to seeing how they might fix some of the problems that I felt the later books had. But it's off to a really good start. Michael, why don't you go next and give our listeners your recommendations this go around?
Sure. So this January, I returned to where I served my mission in northern Argentina for the first time since my mission. And in preparation, I reread two mission memoirs. The first is Way Below the Angels by Craig Harleen. He's a BYU history professor who writes about his LDS mission in Belgium in the 1970s. And it's a really beautiful meditation on what it is like to be a missionary and kind of the graces that he's been able to see in his experience over time, including just continuing relationships with people in Belgium, whether they stayed LDS or did not, coming to understand his fellow missionaries and the like. It's a wonderful memoir. I recommend it. The other one is more obscure. So it's called Nurturing Doubt. It's by a man named Elmer Miller. He first went to Northern Argentina, where I served, including some of the same cities, in the 1950s as a Mennonite missionary and worked among the indigenous peoples there. Interestingly, the Mennonites were not trying to establish their church, but were instead decided to just put things in place for the indigenous people to found their own church, which still exists today. Very, very popular among those people. But here's the thing. After about 5 years as a missionary, he came back to the States, got a PhD in anthropology, and returned to the area as an anthropologist. So he's able to look at his experiences as a missionary and as an anthropologist, looking at his interactions with people and comparing kind of different modes of epistemology and knowledge gathering, as well as his orientation towards people and how his faith and professional background influenced that. It's a really good book. I like it a lot.
That sounds really interesting. I might have to put that on my to-read list. Thank you for those recommendations.
Yeah, it's hard to find, but Nurturing Doubt by Elmer Miller, if you can find it.
That's the problem being an academic with no access to interlibrary loan programs. Maybe I'll have to have Liz get it for me from BYU when I move to Utah this summer.
I don't know. I'm reading for the Inkling Scholarship Award and all of my ILL credit, I think, is used up.
Okay. I'm sure I can find someone. Ivan, what have you got for us this time?
So they're both in the same theme because I'm reading them together. The first one is Vengeance is Mine, The Mountain Meadows Massacre and Its Aftermath by Richard Turley and Barbara Jones Brown, which is just the follow-up to Massacre at Mountains Meadow with Oxford Press. The first one just covered the massacre, and this one covers the aftermath, which is getting the kids back to their relatives, uncovering the crime, trying to arrest the people, John D. Lee's trial, things like that. It's just really interesting looking at what happened, because a lot of the people who were involved in the massacre probably could have been caught and convicted if the prosecutors hadn't been so zealous about, like the book even shows, they wanted to disenfranchise all Mormons everywhere. They wanted to make it be a crime just to be a Mormon. They were so obsessed with making this about that they actually wound up delaying the trial, deliberately creating hung juries. They basically hamstrung their own prosecution. So a lot of the people that they wanted to try that were indicted got away because the prosecutors were just too hyper-focused on trying to take down everybody.
Including trying to get Brigham Young in on it, right? They wanted to pin it on him, and since the evidence wasn't there, they just kept trying to get the evidence. Sure, it would show up someday, and, well, never did.
Yeah, they kept trying to convince people to finger him, and they wouldn't do it. The other one's convicting the Mormons. It's more of a cultural history, Janice Johnson, about like how the Mountain Meadows Massacre was used in American culture to condemn Mormons and attack them, and a lot of stuff about how that was just because Mormons had actually gone barbaric and become Indians or whatever, as they would say. And so the massacre was just another native raid because the Mormons had stopped being white, stuff like that. I'm only like about halfway through both of those, but it's very fascinating just to see where things went there. So
I've got both of those on my to read list.
Yeah. I have read The Vengeance is Mine. I think this may be the first time actually that somebody has recommended something that at least in a previous episode was already recommended on the podcast. And so the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every recommendation be established. It's a great book, and I can second that recommendation as well, because it's so interesting to see the internal politics between the federal officers and Utah and some of the local non-Mormons, and then with the sort of situation bringing the kids back into the middle of what was then the Civil War. And there's just so many moving parts. It's a fascinating book to read. So yeah, one that's highly recommended. We will have links to all these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through these links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and beautiful in pop culture. And now, on to our main discussion of the Dune movies by Denis Villeneuve. I just want to go around the horn really quick and just get everybody's 30 to 60 second view on both movies together. I'll go first. I felt the first one was trying to be a faithful sort of recreation of the book and hit most of the points. And there are a couple of criticisms I had about, oh, I wish I'd had the scene at the banquet where you see how good a politician both Paul and his father are and how they're noble people and why you want these people to take control of Arrakis or maybe the Imperium. But it was really good. And then the second one I thought took a sharp turn to being more of an adaptation, if that makes sense. We're gonna start moving the puzzle pieces around in different ways so that we can really focus on this one particular theme and make sure that it's hit. And I found that a little jarring myself, but overall, I think the two movies were just a masterful bit of science fiction and one that I heartily recommend to everybody. But I'd be curious to get everybody else's take on this as well. Ivan, why don't we have you go first?
I mean, as movies, they were brilliant, honestly, just amazing. Directed, acted, special effects, amazing. As movies, if the book hadn't existed and they'd somehow just been their own thing, they would have been automatic classics. They're just great. But when it starts getting into adaptation, then we start getting a little more into issues with the source material and the differences. But as cinema, they were great. It was just amazing cinema.
Liz, how about you? What do you think?
When I first watched Dune 1, I felt it was very slow. I was pretty worried coming into Dune 2, being like, I don't know if I can take another long desert shot for anymore. I'm done. I felt not much happened in part one. Going back and rewatching it now, I see the setup better and listening to the book again. Oh yeah, the beginning of the book is kind of like that. So it works. But part two was amazing for me. I think that the changes they made in the adaptation made it more filmable, made it a better story for the medium, which is always what you want to get in adaptation, because Dune, every scene takes place at least half in the character's head, because it's all about the psychology and I'm going to outthink you. We're playing 3D chess with each other. So half of the action is going on in the character's heads, and that doesn't work well in a screen adaptation unless you're willing to do voiceovers, and then it still doesn't work well.
And then you get 1984 Dune.
Exactly.
Which was basically all voiceovers.
And so you can see why they had to change some of the emphasis, because you couldn't do that.
Michael, what's your real quick take on the two movies together?
The way I've described it is that Villeneuve did something amazing. He managed to make Dune comprehensible. The book is very strange in structure, in pacing, in a lot of things, but the film is able to bring out characters, relationships, motivations, emotions, and just gorgeous set pieces and landscapes in ways that are, from my recollection, it's been years since I've read the book, are not present in the novel. And so for most people, I would recommend watching the films instead of trying to read the book.
Oh, interesting.
Hot takes.
I don't know if that's heresy or not, but I think that speaks to how well done of an adaptation it is that someone as smart as you, Michael, can say something that is generally considered blasphemous among these kinds of people that we have gathered here. But I dig it.
The other thing is that I think the book is particularly difficult. It is a very weird book. And for people who don't have time for a 600 page weird book, they can sit down and watch 5 hours of excellent films.
Fair. That's fair.
Or they can watch a Sci-Fi Channel miniseries. I'm just kidding. Nobody's mentioned that one yet, the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries.
Oh man, the Children of Dune one is, oh.
Yeah, they tried to keep the bizarreness of the original, but it was hampered by budget.
But I think Michael has a good point that Dune is really hard. I first read Dune when I got married, because it's a big thing in my husband's family. Dune would come up and they'd all start reciting the litany against fear. And I'd be like, what cult did I marry into? What is going on here? Because I had never read Dune. So I had to read it out of self-defense and watch all the adaptations. But even being someone who just graduated with an English degree, I was like, what is happening? And I gave up halfway through Dune Messiah. I'm done. I did it. I'm good. Reading it now, I'm a little bit more of advanced of a reader even than I was then. And so I got it more of it this time around. But it is a tough book.
Most people make it to Children of Dune before giving up, which I don't blame them, honestly. Children of Dune is a tough book to get through.
The first time I was reading Dune, it was in high school, and I got only 60% of the way through before I was just like, I don't like Paul as a character, and most of the book is just in his head. I'm going to put it away.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I read it in high school, but I think it actually shaped what I love about science fiction. I just love being immersed into these just totally bizarre alien worlds. It's one of the few books I'll reread anytime. Some books I read once, okay, it was good, then I'm done. But Dune, I've read it like 6 or 7 times, and I would reread it again in a second. To me, Dune actually reads more like fantasy than science fiction, because it actually is a lot like Lord of the Rings. It's got like the appendixes, it's got the encyclopedia, all the writings from the princess that are referenced all the time. Like when I wrote my master's thesis at BYU, I had a chapter on Dune, and I actually called it science fantasy. And Gene Wolfe's book, The New Sun, was one of the books in Dune, and a couple other books. But I liked that really in-depth world building that you usually don't get as much in science fiction, but you do get in fantasy.
Yeah, I remember I taught a institute class once. We were talking about genres in the New Testament. And so I read them the first 2 paragraphs of Dune, and I said, what genre is this? And most of them said fantasy, because you have a witch. But then someone's like, but he touched the globe and it just lit up. Yeah, because it's magic. And there were just a couple of things that showed you that this is mixing some stuff up, which is one of the great strengths, I think, of Dune, is the world building. Something that I think the movies showcased very well, just all the different moving parts of the Imperium, the Bene Gesserit, the Fremen, and even in part 2, the different factions within the Fremen, which are a creation of the movie, but I think still works well to elicit forth the themes they're trying to go for. The whole ecology of Dune, of course, and spice and sandworms and all this sort of stuff, I think were quite fun to see. It seemed explicated in the movies in a way that would help you make sense of all of it that didn't turn out to be made in Butler dialogue.
Well, and you don't need, the first time I watched the 1984 movie, I had my whole in-laws behind me being like, oh, and this is that, and this is how it works, and now you can understand it. The film is just a master of mentioning things once or twice without making it awkward, without making it like, this is going to be important later, and it's so comprehensible and natural, which is really tough to do well.
I rewatched part 1 this past week, and I noticed that they were setting up everything for part 2 already in part 1. And there were things that I just didn't notice because they weren't planting flags. It wasn't like, behold, this is a gun that belongs to Chekhov.
Yeah, at the same time, they trusted the audience to get it. With the 1984 Dune, one thing that most people may not remember unless they actually went to the theater to see it, they actually were so afraid audience would get it. You got a little pamphlet that had key terms and background defining what terms, certain terms are. And so it's a collector's item now, if you can find somebody who has one, but they actually would like you go to the thing and they'd be like, okay, here's, you bought the ticket. Okay, here's your Dune booklet to explain what you're about to watch.
Amazing.
That reminds me of watching the Lord of the Rings series on Amazon Prime, where I watched the first 3 minutes and then it showed the 2 trees. And I was like, what are those? Hit pause. Went and read the Silmarillion and then came back and hit play, basically, right? Obviously, this took over a week or two, but that's amazing. I did not know that about the 1984 one, which is, again, just the strength of Herbert's work, that it's so well textured and layered and there's so many things going on.
But they do have to cut a lot of things, right?
Oh, they cut so much.
They cut so much. My husband was so sad the Mentats barely show up at all, and that's like a really cool part for him.
Guild navigators were a huge driver of the plot in the books. They don't even exist as far as the movies are concerned.
Yeah.
He really focused it down onto the sort of religious question of, are messiahs good? What kinds of people become messiahs? What circumstances exist to create them in a political situation? He really drilled down on that for the movies and left a couple of the other sort of themes of the book to the wayside.
Yeah, just little things. There's a brief mention of spice for space travel, and there's nothing from the books where rich people use it as a life-enhancing. In the books, the Emperor's 70, but he actually has like the He's 30 years old physically because he takes spice so much. In the movie, the emperor's just his doddering old 70-year-old. Nobody uses spice except the Fremen, apparently. But it's the most important thing ever. I get you have to cut some stuff out, but boy, there was so much cut out. I almost felt like it was like a Cliff Notes version of Dune. If anybody even gets the reference of Cliff Notes anymore.
Yeah.
No, that's fair. That's why I liked it. That's why maybe I need to go rewatch part one again with part two more in mind, because I did rewatch it for this to see how he was thinking of the whole arc. It felt to me there was a bit of a disjunct between one and two. Maybe that's wrong, but he really does want to focus on this theme that I would like us to talk a little bit about. Like for Tolkien, it's the return of the king. It's a very moral universe. Aragorn is such a good man that when he comes to the throne, it's like this golden age that's going to come. It's a very Christian worldview, Catholic in particular. I'm glad I read the Silmarillion after I got my PhD in Catholic theology, because I don't think I would have understood it quite as well. But Dune, of course, is... Nobody tries to politically map themselves over onto the Fremen like they would maybe Gondor or something like that. There are no heroes here. No, there's no good guys. Paul's as close as you get, but that's complicated and problematic. What do we think about the way, first of all, the way the overall story kind of hits those themes, and then how Villeneuve himself adapted them in these two movies?
I appreciated that the themes were drawn out more of the dangers of political charisma, because I, several years ago at a convention here on faith and speculative fiction, sat through a talk where someone argued that Herbert's writing of Dune proved that the natural yearning of humanity was for authoritarian leadership, that an ecologist would write a book where a messiah figure took control of an empire. And yeah, there's a reason why fans of authoritarians today like to call their favorite politicians God Emperor. There are a lot of people who read these books and entirely missed some of Frank Herbert's points about the dangers. And so I'm very glad that the movie does not shy away from those facts, and having characters feel tormented by the machinations that put them in these circumstances. So yeah, that's something that I really appreciate about the movies that does not come out in the books.
It's possible to miss it. I remember it's a little more obvious in the later books. I had a similar thing at a academic conference probably 20 years ago. Somebody gave a talk where they talked about the hero's journey, and they actually brought up Dune as one of the examples of just a standard cookie cutter hero's journey.
Tell me you haven't read the book without telling me you haven't read the book.
I think you'd get it from just reading Dune, even though Paul keeps having visions of the jihad. It just stops right at the point where it seems like we've completed the hero's journey. So I could see that. But I actually asked the guy after it was over. I said, hey, have you read any of the other Dune books? And he's like, no, I've only read the first one. And I was like, well, that explains it. This is not a hero's journey. It's like a deconstruction, basically, the whole hero's journey. It's a flawed hero. It leads to this tyranny. It leads to death, destruction, all this stuff. So he really should go read Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, at least. Because in Dune Messiah, it'll be interesting to see what it is in the movie, because that's where Paul just finally says, crap, I've screwed everything up. I'm just going to go wander off into the desert, and just leaves it all behind because he just realizes how much damage he's caused and he can't do anything to fix it. But if you don't read past the first book and you just don't think about the first book too much, yeah, you can't get that. So I think in the movie, the director here says, I'm going to make sure nobody misses it.
But he still does it well and doesn't beat you over the head with it.
Yeah, once Paul has the water of life, from then on, the music around him especially is really creepy. Up to that point, he's got standard issue heroic music. But then once he has the water of life and he wakes up and he's like, there's this middle way that the only one, but they wouldn't hear, but I see how. And the music at that point is just everything. Every time on the screen, it's super creepy music. I was noticing that today. I was like, wow, they really just decided to make sure we don't miss it. This is not good.
Oh, I was going to say, if you can just read Dune and remain confused about the ambiguity of this, it might be a flaw in Frank Herbert's plotting.
The first trilogy through Children of Dune is like his original vision. So he probably just figured this is the whole trilogy. And so when people stop into Dune, yeah. And yeah, that's probably a flaw with Herbert not realizing he needed to foreshadow more, but that's still there with the whole visions of the jihad and stuff. But the director of the movie was like, I'm going to make sure nobody misses it this time.
I really liked the change that it made in the movie, treating Paul not only as a messiah, but treating the Fremen as the people responding to that, right? I feel like they're much more complex than they are in the book. They're more fully rounded, that we have not all Fremen are the same. They don't all believe the same about the prophecies, which, of course, as religious people, we like that nuance there, that there's not one kind of religious person. There are people who are more fanatical and more fundamentalist, and people who are more liberal and less supernatural. And we see all of those through different Fremen characters in the movie, which I thought was a real plus that complicated that religious war, religious fanaticism kind of message that was going on there. And ask, what does that look like from the inside rather than something that you take over and use?
And I'm just going to be really interested to see what they do with Chaney in the third movie, because she's out. That is literally how the movie ends. Spoilers. She's riding to the southern wastes on a sand worm. I'm like, I'm out of it. I'm out of here. See y'all later. You go fight the Imperium on your own time.
The Chaney of the movies is not the Chaney of the books. Of all the characters, she's basically in name only. I get why they made the changes, give her a bigger role, help her bring out the themes more, but it's not the Chaney of the books at all. She's not even close, really. And I think it works for the movie, probably bring out the themes like he was trying to. It helps to have a major character do that, especially when close to Paul. But Paul's still pretty close to Paul in the books. His mom's still, but Chaney's just a totally different character.
Well, and speaking of Fremen too, I don't recall much of the books, but I don't recall there being any humor. And I really appreciated Stilgar being a character who could convey both gravitas and authority, and also be really just straight up funny at times in a very endearing way.
Yes. Yeah. The whole internet has been taken over by Stilgar memes.
Yeah. In the books, they're very serious. They're pretty monolithic too, like Liz was saying. And yeah, there's not really any humor there. There was some interesting changes in the book. It's this really moving moment where Paul cries and they're like, he gives water to the dead. That's so moving and touching.
When he kills Jaymes at the end of Dune 1, the beginning of Dune 2, we don't really see this.
But yeah, then Dune 2, where his mom cries and Stilgar's like, don't give water to the dead. That's bad. That's wasting water. And I'm like, wow, that's a pretty big change.
It was interesting to me that of all the changes they made, the one that I thought, aside from Chaney, the one they affected the most is that his sister is in utero the entire movie, but telepathically seems to be the driving force getting the mom to get him to be the messiah to engage with all these Bene Gesserit. And I'm like, why are we still listening to this fetus? Yeah, anyway, I look forward to seeing Anya Taylor-Joy portray St. Alia of the Knife in the third movie. That's just going to be so interesting.
The thing is, they wouldn't call her St. Alia of the Knife in the third movie because she was called that because she killed Baron Harkonnen with a knife in the book.
That's true.
Here, she's not even born yet, so she can't kill him with a knife.
But it was probably a good choice because you can't make a fully adult four-year-old not weird in a film.
I think that's one of the things the 1984 movie actually did okay, was getting the weird Alia, four-year-old Alia. They did a pretty good job making a creepy four-year-old, but that was Dave Lynch, so he's pretty good at making creepy four-year-olds anyway.
We still laughed at Alia when we watched the 1984 version.
Yeah.
And this, so that's a reasonable choice just from a movie-making perspective. We can't come up with a four-year-old actress who would act like somebody with all the genetic memory of her predecessors who was like fully adult. So we're just going to have her be in utero the whole time telepathically talking to Jessica. And it did seem that she was a major driver of the plot, and I find that interesting that she believes in Paul so strongly, even though she doesn't really know what's going on out there. I don't know. Anyway, an interesting, a reasonable choice from a movie-making perspective that had some interesting ramifications in the plot and how the movie itself unfolds.
Yeah, it's like they decided they didn't want to do the time skip the book does. Ollie is born. Paul and Chaney have a kid. Ali is born. He's been training for a long time. They decide, no, we're just going to compress all this real quick and make it happen a lot sooner. And so much had to change because of that. You make one little change and that just kept cobwebbing out and made a whole bunch of other changes.
So what I'd like to also have us talk a little bit about the theme of religion as always being false and just used to manipulate the unwashed masses. The Bene Gesserit plant these myths on all the worlds of the Imperium so they can use them when they need them. And this one turns out to be super useful and true at the same time, because the Kwisatz Haderach is now here. He can see into the future. And there's just some interesting themes going on there that I'm not sure all the four of us as believers in something would totally jive with. But I think also, I'm pretty sure I know the four of us well enough to know that we also are sympathetic to the idea that religion can be misused, and obviously in some cases has been throughout world history. So what do we think about the looking at this as believers, but also being sympathetic to some of the points that Herbert and now Villeneuve are making about the use and abuse of religion, to borrow a phrase from Nietzsche?
Herbert said he wrote the book because he had two things. He'd done a lot of work with sand dunes for the government, and so he knew all this stuff about how the behavior of dunes, and two, he had the idea that heroes are bad for society. And you can look at that throughout history. Hitler's the ultimate example, but even like Robespierre or other people, or putting your faith in some strong man to fix everything is obviously a problem. It's not necessarily the religious one, but yeah. So I'm sympathetic to that idea that heroes can sometimes, when you want to turn all your agency over to them, but you know, at the same time, we need inspiration. I don't know. Hard to believe we're all just autonomous individuals who don't need anybody outside of us to ever inspire us to do better, which is where Herbert seemed to be going with it. I don't know.
One thought I had is that, especially with Bene Gesserit and everything, is that I think the most unbelievable part of Dune and its world building is that there are conspiracies that like unfold over the course of thousands of years, basically flawlessly until this point. Until Jessica decides she's going to bear a son instead of a daughter like she was ordered. And Paul goes and does his other things. Like, as people often mention with regard to conspiracy theories, no one who has ever tried to do any amount of project management can believe in a conspiracy theory, much less one that unfolds flawlessly over tens of thousands of years. So I think that you have to take these things seriously because it's the foundation of Frank Herbert's world. But I think the belief that religion is basically an effective conspiracy over thousands of years or even hundreds or even decades just does not hold up to scrutiny in the real world, because religions are constantly changing. If you go back to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 1836 and try to have a conversation with them, there are some things that would be mutually recognizable, but probably most that would not.
As far as what the Bene Gesserit is trying to do, the movie's that weird thing in the second part where the whole reason the Atreides were wiped out was because the Bene Gesserit were pissed off that she'd had a son instead of a daughter. In the books, it's not at all. In the books, it's the Navigation Guild. The Bene Gesserit are just going along with it because it's like easier.
Oh, I'm including the Navigation Guild among the conspirators.
But in the books and the movie, like, they had multiple branching lines. They probably had at least 100 different ways the Kwisatz Haderach could have been produced. There are even characters in some of the later novels, especially the third novel, that are like dead end characters from dead end Kwisatz Haderach lines and stuff like that. But again, the movie really had to simplify it. But he was really the master of plots within schemes, within conspiracies, within plans, within more plots. Every plot was like six or seven layers deep in the book. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, there may be two layers deep, but that's easier for the audience to follow. But yeah, actually having all those moving parts work for thousands of years is a bit stretching credulity. You're right.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, though, but I'm going to go to bat for the Bene Gesserit here for a second. If your goal is to create the Kwisatz Haderach, and there are multiple ways to get to that goal, then you can see how, if you had a group dedicated to this one sort of end goal, it doesn't matter how you get there. That seems a little more plausible to me, especially with dead end lines. And there's even a moment in the book where the Reverend Mother is looking at the knife fight now between these two cousins who know their cousin, at least Paul knows, between the Harkonnen kid and between Paul. She's, oh man, this is going to be a disaster for our genetic breeding program, because these are the two lines we were expecting that would eventually. And so it feels like the idea of religion as manipulation is second fiddle to their end goal of creating the male Bene Gesserit, the Kwisatz Haderach. So I don't know, that feels different to me than just we're going to use religion to manipulate people. You know, they have this one specific goal and they're going to use all available methods to get to that.
They are super hyper-focused on that because I remember in the Messiah, they're getting ahead, but there's that really icky part where the Reverend Mother's like, ah, that Cheney girl's mucking up the bloodline. What we need to do is get Paul alone with his sister a lot so that they can have a kid. And you're like, what the frack? That's how hyper-focused they are. They just don't care about anything but getting there in some ways.
I think it's really interesting to think about Dune from the question of, can religious fundamentalism be caused, but also the converse of that, prevented? In the film, for sure, it emphasizes how long Paul tries to fight this role that he sees for himself, that he's going to end up being leading this jihad, right? That they're being pressured into because they have no other outlet. And I think that's a really good lesson that we could learn, that fundamentalism and religious conflict develops when people are backed into a corner. And when we're not talking to each other, and when we're depriving people of resources, and people are in a geopolitical isolation, and they feel like their only thing they can do is turn to this identity to move forward. And that's what's going on in Arrakis. And they point out that's also how the Sadakar are being created on this prison planet. The prison planet is for the purpose of creating people who are strong and hardened and fanatical. And the same thing is happening on Arrakis because they live in this harsh conditions. They're being exterminated by the Harkonnens. So they have these external pressures. So I think it does say that, yeah, religious belief is part of it, but it also has to do with politics. It has to do with economies. All these different factors go into it. It's not as simple as, well, religious belief creates religious fundamentalism and therefore all religion bad.
Richard Dawkins.
I was thinking Krakauer way, right? Under the banner of heaven, where if people have religious beliefs, they will be fundamentalists. That's it.
Yeah. Everybody who believes in God is one revelation away from murdering their neighbors. And Herbert is certainly better than that. But that was something I really appreciated about this movie, is that it showed the sort of multifaceted way that Paul was being pressured to end up taking this role. He has his family life. He has his weird beetle sister who's giving his mom sort of orders, but he's got that pressure from that end. He's got the Fremen who want him to be the Lisan al-Ghaib.
He's got the Harkonnen who are carrying out atrocities.
And he's got this desire to avenge his father, like all of these different things.
To tie it into that book I recommended, the Vengeance is Mine, like where the prosecutors didn't get everybody because they were so overshooting the mark. If the Harkonnen had just been like, okay, fine, we got Arrakis back. We wiped out the Atreides. We're good. As opposed to, let's wipe out all the Fremen. That's the big instigation, is the fact that the Harkonnens are like, we're going to wipe out all the Fremen now. And like, they really didn't have much choice. It was either accept being wiped out completely or go on this jihad.
I will note, one change I really did like about the films is that they replaced the word jihad with holy war.
Yeah, they didn't really use the word jihad a lot, yeah.
They didn't. And I'm sure it was specifically because when Herbert wrote it, he was participating in orientalizing discourse about Arabs and Muslims and just using this as like the generic term. But it's not a generic term in Islam. It's a much broader meaning. That was a very deliberate choice on the film's part. And it allows it to be more generic as opposed to, here's a bit of a caricature of the Middle East.
In the books, it is a mix because there's a talk about the jihad from the Fremen, but also something totally missing from the movies is the Butlerian jihad, which in Herbert's books, not counting the other books by other people I don't want to mention.
That we will not name.
In Herbert's books, the Butlerian jihad was actually more of an intellectual philosophical movement. It was more like, hey, thinking machines are taking away our agency. Let's just get rid of them so that we can actually be human. Jihad used both for like war, deadly killing, and intellectual, philosophical, moral stuff. So it's a lot, the books are a lot more nuanced than that. But yeah, in today's contemporary society, just saying the word jihad is socio-politically touchy. So it's a good reason not to use it in the movies.
That whole thing about AI taking away our agency and stuff. I don't know, you guys, give it 10 to 15 years at the rate we're going. We may need to do our own Butlerian jihad. And I hope if we do, we'll have to smash all of our iPhones. I hope we call it the Butlerian jihad. because that would just be a great little cultural touchstone. Yeah, for that, you can go listen to our episode on AI in the movies, which I thought hit on some interesting themes, this thing. We've been going for about an hour now. Are there any major points that need to get brought up?
We haven't discussed things like prophecy, signs, and destiny.
We should talk about how bald people are evil. That's what we should talk about.
Got me.
Yeah, that was a very interesting aesthetic choice for the Harkonnens. I've heard it so many different ways in audiobooks. In the movie, it's like Harkonnen, but in audiobooks, I've heard Harkonnen, Harkonnen. I don't even know. So it's like,
I pronounce it Harkonnen because it looks like a Finnish name.
That Austin Butler, man, knocked it out of the park as Fade. I thought he was so interesting and a bit of a caricature in some ways, more because they weren't dealing with the sort of themes that were relevant to his character. But let's talk really briefly then just about signs and prophecies and things that we can glom onto as a form of religious faith or something. How do we think the movie dealt with some of those topics that Herbert brings up as well? Again, with the conceit that the Bene Gesserit have seeded prophecies and omens and foretellings and foreshadowing so that they could maybe pick them up thousands of years later if those happen to still exist. But again, as people who believe in prophets, seers, and revelators, but maybe not the Bene Gesserit witches or the Kwisatz Haderach, how do we deal with such themes here in the movie and in our own lives?
The movie did a good job of showing a range of these. Of course, you have all of the Stilgar memes of Lisa Nagaib going around.
Lisa Nagaib!
Showing how everything is a sign. You can interpret everything as a sign. Oh, he denies that he is the Lisa Nagaib. So that would be exactly what the Lisa Nagaib would say. That kind of circular logic that you can get into that can get you into trouble. But then there are other places where the movie leaves you enough doubt that you're like, oh, it is weird that Chaney's name is the Desert Spring, and then she brings him back. That is a weird coincidence. How do you explain that? And I think it did a good job of showing a more full picture of religion rather than being just, oh, these were seeded by the Bene Gesserit, and now we're going to use them.
The thing that I always liked about the Dune book is it showed how these kind of best laid plans start falling apart.
Yeah,
I mean, that's one of the points of the book is that they seeded all these things hoping they could exploit them, and then it blew up in their faces. And the Bene Gesserit, yeah, by the end of the third book especially, they are not getting what they want. And at the end of the first book, their plans are totally toast. And it shows how that's very uncontrollable. The theme of religious leaders still being dangerous to society is still there. But the idea that religion isn't really controllable is also actually important. You can't really just say, oh, yeah, we'll just use this to control the masses because you don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-mm. I guess a question you have to answer then to even attempt Carl's question is, what do you define as prophecy?
Yeah.
It's like a Deep Space Nine. Remember that episode where the person's like, they're the prophets. No, they're just aliens in a wormhole. And Sisko's son is like, well, they're just aliens in a wormhole. And Sisko's like, well, they can see the future. Shouldn't we just consider that prophets? And the son's like, no, it's more complicated. Anyway.
Deep Space Nine is probably the best overall treatment of religion in Star Trek as a whole, no doubt.
I don't know that we're going to, on our podcast in the next 10 minutes, wrap up a solid way to tell and never fall for weird signs and always know the right good signs.
Well, if it's by somebody with the last name Daybell, stay far away.
Yes.
For that, you can listen to our friend's podcast on angels and seer stones.
Oh, the Chad Daybell series is called Demons and Pendulums. Anyway, fantastic name. But I do think that, like we talked about how the history and the politics and the economics of Dune is so complicated, that all of those go into the elements of different signs and how things get fulfilled. And we can see that in LDS history as well, right? Because our own religion was founded in the age of written documentation, that we have all of these experiences of, oh, this is more complicated than a straight, clean narrative would make it in hundreds of years, right? And Dune is doing that same kind of thing. So it feels a little bit familiar to you as a Latter-day Saint where, yeah, we believe that there was a prophecy about Zion, but then we got kicked out of Jackson County. So now what? What are we going to do? how do we reconcile that prophecy in our own tradition is complicated by economics, by politics, and all these things.
Which is why I think Dune as a whole, and both the book and the movies, are such great works of art, because you can look at them and draw so many themes and thoughts and conclusions and have such good discussions and see both the power and the danger of all of these different facets of our lives. And I think Villeneuve's done a marvelous job, and I look forward to seeing what he does in part three. I was surprised to hear that he got a part three already, but before they even released part two. And I'm really looking forward to seeing somebody with a really clear vision of Paul's arc just doing that really well. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. He's one of the few guys, he and Darren Aronofsky, like the two people who, oh, he's making something? I'm going to go see that in the theaters.
Yeah, if people haven't seen his Arrival, oh my goodness, go see it.
I read somewhere he's working on a spin-off TV series about the Bene Gesserit. I don't know where I read that, though. I'd have to go look it up.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a Bene Gesserit series on HBO Max at some point, and we'll a spin-off of these movies. We'll see how that goes. I'm intrigued, but also wary.
Yeah, the HBO Max thing with Bene Gesserit, like, scares me.
What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? Oh, dear.
So many things.
Anyway, yeah, and if you want to listen to, we did an episode on Arrival on the podcast. You can go back and listen to that if you're interested. There's a lot of good themes in there as well.
Well, that's one thing actually about the Dune movies, I should say. If we talk about like content, he had to simplify, and I'm glad by simplifying, he did something that the sci-fi miniseries didn't do, which is he cut out pretty much all the sexual content. Like the Harkonnen's weird sexual fetishes, all gone. The Bene Gesserit's brainwashing through sex, pretty much all gone. All that kind of stuff. Just because, one, this means older kids can watch it with me now. There's a little bit more too much violence to the youngest kids. Other than a little bit of cussing and maybe violence inappropriate for a little bit of the youngest kids, I actually think you could watch it with a family if they're older teenagers.
And the most violent part of this movie was on Getty Prime, and it's all filmed in black and white. And it was just a really interesting sequence to see how he had the conceit of the Dark Star making everything hues of black and white and gray and nothing else. Yeah. And it just lent an air to that part of the movie that was so different. And I totally dug it. I was here for it. But that's a great transition then into our ratings segment. We give every movie three different ratings. And the first one is content, clean versus objectionable material. Is it celestial, terrestrial, telestial, or outer darkness? Ivan, you just gave us your overview. What would you, just to wrap up your thought right there, where would you put this movie on our scale of the LDS after?
Terrestrial.
Terrestrial? Okay.
Yeah, terrestrial, yeah.
I think I would say that as well. Terrestrial is pretty good. I was surprised how much they defanged the utter horror of the Harkonnen. I'm still traumatized by the 1984 depictions. Really crazy stuff.
I will admit that I have the question as to why everyone in the Harkonnen universities is not taught that the first rule of working in politics is never to contradict a Harkonnen.
So you put it on terrestrial as well then, Liz. Michael, where would you put it?
Oh my goodness, this is a very hard scale because some of the most celestial things are also much more violent than these movies.
It's true. And that's part of why we have the three, and we recognize it's an imperfect system, but do your best and you can do whatever you want with this rating system.
Oh boy, I really don't know. Yeah.
I just think the religious violence is a little bit too much for me to give it a celestial, basically, because that is a really complex and tough, dark theme that I wouldn't want to watch with necessarily every person.
Yeah. The thing that would most give me pause is the cruelty of the Harkonnens. In part one, you see some of that with them torturing folks. But then again, there's maybe terrestrial, but it's only just be aware that this is happening. Crazier things happen than scriptures you read with your kids every night.
Sure.
But there's some difference between reading it and watching it.
Like, it's very true, yes.
Visual mediums are different for some
people. Yeah, just be aware.
And again, hats off to Austin Butler for playing a pretty darn good psychopath in Fade Ralph. Interesting choices there. I'm going to give it Telestial, and I'll give you my reasons why. Because the Harkonnens have taken the treasures of Arrakis, and with Solari, bought up Sardaukar armies and guild navies. false Bene Gesserit priestesses who oppress an Akwisatz Haderach who will reign with blood and horror throughout the Imperium. Seems to me this is pretty telestial. I don't know about you guys.
Have you been working on that for a while?
I have, actually. I think this is the world in which we now live, with all of its complexity, the good and the bad and all that. I feel it's telestial for me, which is why, however, moving to our next rating, Artistic Merrick, a 1 to 5 popcorn balls, I'm going to go first, and I'm just going to give it 5 popcorn balls, because it really does a good job of portraying the world in which we now live. If we could travel in space and had Mentat thinking computers like 10,000 years in the future or whatever else, it's very human. It's very recognizable, even with all of the fantastic science fantasy stuff going on as well. So I'm going to give it 5 popcorn balls. Liz, we'll have you go next on this one.
I mean, what is there to say? It deserves 5. The music is spot on. The cinematography is spot on. The casting is amazing. There's hardly a bad note in the movie. It's pretty darn near perfect. So 5, if anything gets a 5, this gets a 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm ditto.
All right. Michael, what are you going to give it?
I think I would say 5. I think the first part is stronger than the second part for a variety of small reasons, but a lot of the strengths of the first part also carry over.
That's fair. I can see that. Just give me one example of something you think the first part is stronger than the second part.
I like how much more meditative it is and how it creates a sense of wonder. I feel like the second part gets really caught up in plot many times, and things that are just like the revelation of the sandworms is stunning in the first part. And in the second part, they're freight trains.
Which is really cool, but I get you.
Really cool freight trains, but yes.
Really cool freight train.
No, that reminds me of, I was watching a commentary on Batman the Animated Series, and the first time they show the Batmobile, it gets like its whole sort of orchestral theme, and they show it zooming around for 60 seconds, and then in the rest of the series, oh, there's the Batmobile, it's just there. So, yeah, I feel you on that. And our last rating is Gospel Connections, Morally Edifying Messages. Again, do with that what you will. That's just the rating system we've created here and that we use. 1 to 5 apricots. Michael, I'm going to put you on the spot and see if you want to go first.
And this is one reason I think I would kind of prefer the film to the book. Like, I think it depicts the things that we need to grapple with a little more cleanly and clearly, and it humanizes them instead of the 1970s sci-fi. Let's look at tens of thousand years of history and project what things will be like. So I would say 5. It's important to live in the shoes and in the heads of these characters as they grapple with these questions. None of us will be deciding the fate of a world or a universe, but we also have to grapple with ideas of vengeance, of justice, of governmental systems, of how do we change our situations around us? What do we do with our emotions and our complicated family lives? So yeah, I think it's for as trite as it sounds, there's importance here.
I love it. I almost want to cut us off right there. That was good. Ivan, you go next. What do you think?
I'd probably go 4. It's pretty good. Just the whole thing about, since the whole point is like religion just bad, doesn't quite make it to 5. Plus they cut out the Orange Catholic Bible completely. They didn't completely. Thufir Howitt, I think, quotes it a couple times. He quotes it a couple times, but they never really say what it is. But maybe if they had that more, I might give it a higher. I'll say 4. I don't really have a good reason for it, though.
Yeah. I'm going to give it 4 myself, although maybe 4.5. Listeners of the podcast will know I don't want to give it a 5 unless there's an explicitly Christ-centered connection here. But I will say, I am so glad that Jesus Christ is my Messiah, not Paul Atreides.
This one is really hard because I agree with you, Michael, that there are so many important themes to grapple with here. But I think there is an issue that there are no good guys in this show, right? Nobody's making the choices that we want to be able to make. Maybe some of the choices that you have to make. But hopefully none of us are ever in the position where we have to do these kinds of guerrilla warfare against an oppressive regime that's trying to commit genocide. Hopefully that's not a common situation in our everyday lives. So while I love Dune for thinking about these religious themes and all these important things, I'm probably going to give it a 3 just because you have to think outside of the film to be like, who do I want to follow? Probably none of these people. This is good. What not to do? How not to start a holy war? Here you go.
How not to treat your commanders and underlings. Just kill them.
How to be a non-effective manager of a planet. Here you go.
It should be said that Tolkien really disliked Dune. And you can see why, because Tolkien's books are set in a clearly moral universe where the heroes are the little people from this town far away from anything who, through their own self-heroism, end up saving the world. And Dune has none of those themes, like, at all. It's all just a bunch of jerks. It's not quite as bad as something like Game of Thrones, but it's definitely more in the nuance sort of thing. You've convinced me, Liz. Maybe I'll drop mine down to 4.
I think it's important that we need both kinds of books, right? Like, if we read only books like Dune and Game of Thrones, we would be missing part of humanity. But also, if we're reading only books like Lord of the Rings, Chronicles of Narnia, even most Brandon Sanderson, where humanity is optimistic and heroic, we're also missing part of what humanity is. Take that for what you will. Read widely, read different kinds of things. But Dune is definitely an important book for me, and these films do a great job.
And this is one of the reasons I think that the films are better than the books in this respect, because they do bring out the human side. You can see why people are choosing what they're choosing. So, like, the movies do that extraordinarily well in a way that the book does not.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right, thanks for joining us today on Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree. You can find me on Twitter at Carl Cranny. Ivan, where can people find you?
Timesandseasons.org, the LDS blog, Times and Seasons. Yeah.
Excellent. Liz, where can people find you if they want to get in touch with you or see what you're up to?
You can follow my writing and book reviews at lizbusby.com. It's also mirrored on my Substack, which is lizbusby.substack.com. If you follow Substacks, there you go.
Yeah. And Michael, anything you want to plug, social media or whatever else?
I don't really have anything at the moment. I'm not on any public-facing social media. Nothing really that I'm putting out there at the moment. I've wandered off into the desert.
Nothing wrong with that. Thanks for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, share the podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice or on YouTube. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode via email, social media, or our website. It really makes our day as podcast hosts to hear from you, our listeners. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.